Okay, so let's go to the Gemara. And today I really want to set out the conceptual issues that have to do with these communal agreements and what exactly gives them the power that they have, what are the limitations on that power. And it's a little bit annoying to get it all together just because it's spread out over this amud of Gemara. But we'll do what we can. So to review this Gemara that we've seen several times, the Gemara had told us that Tana Rabbanan kupa shel tzedaka nigbei b'shnayim u'mitchalekei b'shlosha, that when you have the tzedaka collection, it's collected by two people and divided by three. Nigbei b'shnayim she'en osim tzarot al hatzibur pachot mishnayim. So as we've already talked about, you need two people to collect the money because any position of authority needs at least two people. And we talked about whether that's for fundamental reasons that they represent the Beit Din or simply for reasons of ne'emanut, that we don't want money collected by a single individual because we're worried about trust. Umitchaleket b'shlosha, it's divided by three, kedinei mamonot, like any other monetary law. But when it comes to the tamchoi, the daily soup kitchen, so then it's both collected and divided by three. Shegivuya v'chaluka shavim. Tamchoi v'chal yom. The tamchoi is the soup kitchen that gives out food every day. Kupa me'erv Shabbat l'erv Shabbat. And the kupa is the weekly, is the tomchei Shabbos type soup kitchen. Tamchui la'aniei olam, kupa la'aniei ha'ir. And the tamchui goes to the people of the world, meaning anyone who wants food. The kupa is only for the people in the city. And then, after it's finished talking about the tzedaka, so the Gemara tells you, rasha'in b'nei ha'ir la'asor kupa tamchui v'tamchui kupa l'shanota l'chol mashiyirtzu. So as we've talked about at length, the people in the community have the right to change, to reallocate the funds from the kupa to the tamchui, or vice versa. And then the Gemara says, v'rasha'in b'nei ha'ir la'atnot al hamidot ve'al ha'she'arim. So what does that mean? Okay, this is what we were up to. So what is rasha'in b'nei ha'ir la'atnot al hamidot ve'al ha'she'arim? The people in the city can do what?
Wait, can your people ask you where it's
Rasha'in? Right, so go back, right? This is the Gemara in Chet Amud Bet. We've seen this several times, but this is the line we're up to. So, Rasha'im b'nei ha'ir, or the people of the city, have the right. La'asot kumpa, we did that. Rasha'im b'nei ha'ir, la'atnot al hamidot, to make a condition about the measurements. Right, so if you look at Rashi says lahagdil sa'at ha'ir o lahaktin. You can change the standard measurements. So if the standard measurement is a cup, and a cup is 8 ounces, and they decide that they want to make a cup be 10 ounces or 6 ounces, or any type of alteration into the standard measurements in the city, they're allowed to. V'ala she'arim. Sha'arim, Rashi says, Sha'ar chitin v'ayayin. That means the price of wine, the price of wheat, shelo yin karena shana zo yoter mikach l'kach damim. They have the right to say that you aren't allowed to charge more than X, more than a certain amount, for wine, for wheat, in a given year. And then the Gemara says, the al schar poalim, they can also make rules about the salaries of workers. Ulahasia al kitzatan, and then latzia al kitzatan. This is one of the most important lines. The Gemara says that not only can they make these rules, but as Rashi says, leknoset over al kitzat divrayim lasiam midat din Torah. They are allowed to enforce the rules that they make by punishing people, even in a way that's not called for by the Torah. Right, so this is the Gemara's overarching principle here, that you have the right, that the people in the city have the right to set certain standards, set certain rules for monetary laws in terms of employee, in terms of labor laws, in terms of measurements and the like, and they can punish those people who those people who don't follow the rules. Okay? Now, after that, we had the whole discussion that we had in our Gemara about 2 and 3 and about coercing for tzedaka, and you get a little bit of a gadata on the middle and bottom of the page, that anyone who judges judgment fairly, so the Gemara praises him in different ways. And then we will come back to the issues of trust when it comes to the Gaba'ei Tzedaka. But this is what you have on Chet Amud Aleph. Now, before we delve into it, we need to see the end of the sugya, which is on the top of Tet Amud Aleph. And the Gemara says as follows. Let's start. Let's start four lines from the bottom on Chet Amud Bet. Right, so the Gemara says, Amar Abaye Meresh Lo Haveyativ Mar Atzife Deve Kinishta Kevan Dishama Lahadetanya Lushanotah Lechol Mashir Yirtzu Haveyativ. So he said, first of all, Abaye used to not sit on these mats in the shul because they were bought from the money of the kupa, and he thought that was stealing from tzedakah. But once he heard that you're allowed to change to whatever you want, so then he would. Now, this weighs in, obviously, on the sugya that we already saw, the Machloket Rabbeinu Tam and the Rimigash and the Ran and the Rash, etc., as to whether you're allowed to change money even l'davar harishut. This Gemara seems very much to favor the position of Rabbeinu Tam, that you're allowed to change it even for optional things. And so much so does it seem to support Rabbeinu Tam that some of the Rishonim suggest that according to the Rimigash, this Girsa is just incorrect. It just doesn't exist in the Gemara. And then the Gemara says that Yotev Amar Abaye Meishavi Ovid Mar Tre Kise Chad L'Aniye D'Alma V'Chad L'Aniye D'Mata. Originally, I used to have two separate wallets. One for the money donated for the poor of the world, meaning not of the city, and one for the people in the city. Kevin D'Shama L'Had Amar Le'Shmuel Rav Tachlifa Bar Avdime. But once I heard that you're allowed to change money and reallocate them, so Ovid Chad Kise, I only made one I only made one wallet. Now, here the Gemara is focusing on the power of the government officials when it comes to tzedakah, which is what's going to lead us into the next line. So, Atniele, right? He said, I would make a condition that I could give the money, I could donate the money to whoever I want. So I can do the same thing. Rashi Amar Ana Atnui Name. I also make this condition, but I don't even need to. Lutzarichna Dichol Dikaati Adaita Didi Ati. I can reallocate resources, whether or not I actually explicitly make it tonight, because everybody knows when they donate money to the communal funds, they're doing it with having in mind that Rav Ashi will be in charge and will allocate them as he sees fit, and therefore he can reallocate them without making any conditions because everyone understands that's the implied consent. Uleman dibaino yahavna lay, and whoever I want to give it to, I can. No hanu betray. Now, once we're talking about this power of the authority, so the Gemara says hanu betray tabche da avde inyana bahade hadade. There were two shochtim. There were two slaughterers, two butchers who had made a certain condition with each other. The chalman the avid biyoma de chavrei nikreua limashchei, that anybody who would dare work on the other person's day, that basically they divided up turf. The first butcher would work on Sundays, Tuesdays, and Thursdays. The second one would work on Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And you were never allowed to work on someone else's day. And they, in order to enforce those rules, they said that anyone who violates the conditions and works on another day will shred the leather that comes from the shechita to punish them for violating the conditions of the trade. So azol chad minayu avad biyoma dechavrei. So one of the people indeed went and worked on his friend's day. So karu l'mashchei. So they ripped up the leather. Atu l'kamedi Rava. And they came to Rava to challenge this. Why were you allowed to take my property and destroy it? Chayvinu Rava l'shalume. And Rava said, you're right. This was damage. They weren't allowed to destroy your property. So you have to pay him back. So Eitve Rav Yehima bar Shlamya le Rava. Rav Yehima, the son of Shlamya, said to Rava, Ula hasi'a al-katzi al-kitzatan. I don't understand. Didn't we say that people are allowed to make conditions about labor law, about pricing and things like that? So if these butchers made a deal between them, so shouldn't that be enforceable? So lo ahadir le Rava. Rava didn't say anything. He was silent. He didn't have a response. Amar Rav Papa, shapir avid lo ahadir le nide. Rav Papa said that was the right thing because it was obvious that he was correct. Because ani nile heicha deleka adam chashuv. The only time we let the people make these conditions is where there is no important person. I'm going to leave that undefined for the moment. Aval heicha deika adam chashuv lav kol kimanayu dimatnu. Whenever there is an important person, the individuals aren't allowed to make a condition without him. Okay? So that is, in a nutshell, the relevant Gemaras that we need to now move to. So, again, on Chet Amud Bet, the Gemara says that the people of a city have the right to make conditions about labor law, about pricing, and the like, and even enforce their decisions with punishment that isn't warranted by the Torah. But then the Gemara on Tereman Aleph tells the story that there were two butchers who in fact made such a rule and divided up the turf and said one can only work Sunday, Tuesday, Thursday, the other Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and whoever would violate it would be monetarily punished by having their property destroyed. One of the people violated the condition, and the Gemara says he was punished, but when it was brought to court, Rava said, you're not allowed to punish him. And the Gemara says, why not? Aren't you allowed to make conditions about labor? And the Gemara answered, you can, unless there's an Adam Chashuv, unless there's an important person. So what I want to try to understand is the scope of the possibility of making these rules, who does it apply to, what is the role of the Adam Chashuv, what does that tell us about the nature of the power of the individuals to set rules? Right, that's the question that's going to be taking us for at least the next few days. Okay, so today let's try to flesh out the theoretical issues. I know it's a little harder on Zoom, but let's try to do it. So if I ask you, first questions first, where do you think the power comes from that the Gemara legitimates the members of a city setting up labor laws, setting up pricing, setting up measurements, and not only to set up those laws, but to enforce them with punishment, right? Where do you think the justification for that comes from? I know you're on mute, but you're going to have to unmute for me to hear you. I can't tell if I'm hearing the echo from my Ginsburg share or one of you guys.
No, I was saying the town, maybe.
Say it again?
The town.
Meaning what, right? Meaning the first case in the Gemara is that the people in a city are allowed to make such rules. But where does that power come from, right? The Gemara just says that people in a city are allowed to make rules about pricing, about labor, and they're allowed to enforce it. But where does that... Okay, so Yehonatan says, well, maybe it doesn't need a justification, right? We're already in the middle of a sugya that started on Zayin Amud Bet that talks about communal obligations. And as we've already seen, communal obligations, in a certain sense, seem to be self-justifying, right? Now, that's either in a technical sense, the way you saw in Rabbeinu Tam, which is that when I enter into a city, sometimes I happen to enter into deals, or, as we saw from Rishach there, I guess about 2 weeks ago, the possibility that, no, communal obligations, communal responsibilities... are fundamental, right? They are intrinsic to what it means to live in a society, and they mean nothing unless they're enforceable. And therefore, the ability of people in the city to make rules about prices, about labor, and to enforce them derives from this basic stated reality that there are communal obligations, and therefore, if you're living in a city, you can have rules, you can have laws, and you're committed through some sort of, I don't know, social contract, some sort of something, but it's self-justifying in that sense. Okay, so if that's the case, so I have two questions for you, right? Yonatan, you can chat it. I can see your chat, so that's easier. Right, I have two questions. Let's say that that's the case. That the power that the people in the community have to make rules simply derives from the fact that there are communal obligations. And therefore, if there are communal obligations, so they are allowed to obligate each other and they're allowed to enforce the rules. So I have two problems. One is... then what is the role of the Adam Chashuv, right? Meaning if it's just a given that communal obligations can lead to the authority to make rules on each other, so then what is this limitation that we see at the end of the Gemara that you need an Adam Chashuv, that you need an important person, you need a powerful person, right? What does that mean? What does that do? And the second question I want to ask you is, the Gemara invokes that same line of Lasiel Kitzatan to deal with the case of the Tabach, right? To deal with the case of the two butchers. And I want you to weigh in on how does the rule of the butchers, or how does the case of the butchers seem to integrate, because the Gemara doesn't explicitly tell you this, but someone tell me, what's the problem, right? What's the problem with, and I'll come back to your point in the chat, Yonatan, what's the problem with invoking the principle of the community is allowed to make rules and enforce them in the context of two tabachim, of two butchers making rules on each other and enforcing them? Right? What's the problem with invoking that rule in that context? Right? So those are the problems that I think we have to deal with. Okay, so good. So Yehonatan says, correctly, I'm ventriloquizing for Yehonatan through the chat, but Yehonatan says, but wait a second. If his original assumption is correct, that the reason that the people of a community, of a city, are allowed to set prices, are allowed to set labor law, if that derives from whatever power the communal obligations come from, so there needs to be a conceptual justification to transfer this from the case of the community as a whole, the case of the city as a whole, to the case of two butchers, which sounds like localized guild agreements, right? Localized agreements within the economy. And so this, first of all, calls into question how exactly this type of rule can be expanded beyond a case in which the entire city is making a principle, is establishing a principle, because once you're... So Yonatan says, so we have two options here. Well, Yonatan gives me one option. Yonatan said one option is to say that we have to be more expansive about how we understand community. Meaning, the first half of the Gemara talks about community, the entire community, the entire geographic area, the whole city, the whole political entity. But maybe the novelty of the Gemara, when it introduces the same principle for the case of the tabachim, for the case of the butchers, is telling you that community doesn't need to be as wide as you originally thought. It doesn't need to be the whole city. It needs to be, as Yonatan put it here in quotations, a community, in quotation marks, right? A localized community. Maybe. And therefore, I think Yonatan, meaning that's one possibility, right? But if Yonatan is right, then what we need to assume is that we need to go back and redefine what community means. Okay. Now, I think the second thing Yonatan said here is the second possibility, right? Meaning, one is to say that really the rule is that the community is allowed to make rules, and the butchers are a self-contained community, and therefore, it's just a microcosm of the opening of the Gemara. The opening of the Gemara is talking about rules that affect the whole city, and in that sense, the whole community is relevant, the whole city is relevant, and therefore they make rules. When it comes to the Tabachim, maybe they're a self-contained community. Now, I'm not sure if Yonatan is saying one thing or two things in this. But the other possibility, and Yonatan, you can weigh in here whether you think what you're saying is one or two. Right? One is to say that when it comes to the labor laws of the butchers, it makes sense to define community smaller, because it's only relevant to them. And therefore, it logically, right? But the other possibility is to say, no, that these rules look alike. Meaning, there are city laws that come from communal obligations, and then there are labor laws which come from some other rule, right? Guilds can make a rule for themselves, because it doesn't make sense to deal with the normal rules of community on the broad scale. It makes sense to deal with it amongst the people who it's directly relevant to. Now, are those two formulations different? Meaning, is it different to say that for the purpose of these laws, the butchers are a self-contained community, or to say that the reason that the butchers are allowed to set rules for themselves is not because of community, it's because it's only relevant to them? Now, there might be differences, and we'll see. There might be differences. Yeah, what differences might there be?
I would assume one major difference is, like, I mean, it's possible that there might be, I don't know, like, the master butcher or something like that, like, and so therefore, and if we do them as their own community, then only a master butcher will be able to, be able to be the authority figure. And then if there's some, I don't know, other wise person, other, the Makashu, who is just a butcher, then he doesn't really have any say on which one.
Okay, right, so Rami notes that it might have nafkaminas in terms of how we define Adam Chashuv for these purposes, right? Which, you're right, but we haven't gone to Adam Chashuv yet, but you're right. Meaning, if you think that this is essentially the same as the city, so then you say, look, this is really just a small community, but, and therefore they need to have their own Adam Chashuv. But if you say, no, they're really part of the bigger city, and the reason they make the obligation, they can make rules for themselves, is simply because it only affects them, but maybe Adam Chashuv isn't about a member of the guild, it's some sort of limiting principle on the authority, on the authority of anybody in a city to make rules without consulting with the power that be. So that might be a difference, right, is exactly who we define as the Adam Chashuv. But there might be other nafkaminas. So let's say, we'll see, right? What happens if the conditions that a guild makes have implications indirectly for other members of the city, right? Like, I don't know, it causes prices to rise, right? By limiting competition, so they are they're essentially creating a monopoly, right, amongst the guild, and now other people in the city are going to have to pay more. So if you think that, look, they're allowed to make rules for themselves, so they're the butchers, so butchers are allowed to make rules for butchers, so then you might say it doesn't matter if it indirectly affects everyone else by raising the prices. But if you say that they're a self-contained community, it might be hard to say that they're a self-contained community when their rules maybe most directly affect them, but indirectly affect the entire city. So it may affect the extent of what cases we say they're actually allowed to weigh in on. Fine. Now, there's, the fundamental question I just want to highlight here is, again, we can come up with different formulations, but the number one question we need to figure out here is, what is the source of the authority of people to make rules for themselves, and is, in fact, the authority that the entire city has to make rules for themselves, is that the basis for the ability of guilds, of labor unions, essentially, to make rules amongst themselves? If they're identical, so then we need to try to figure out what is the nature of a community such that that's true. But if, in fact, these are functioning at two different levels, then we gotta, right, then these two principles won't shed light on each other. Let's see, it would seem that the guild commonly makes more sense. Is the goal, I think, is to have a better society for everyone, in which case the guild would be able to decide things for themselves unless Adam Chashuv leaves. Okay, we'll come back to Adam Chashuv in 1 second. Okay, but the first major question you need to ask in the sugya, or the first two major questions we need to ask in the sugya, are, one, what is the source of the power of the community to make rules for themselves? And the second question is, what is the source of the power for guilds to make rules for themselves? And is it identical, or an expansion of Rule 1 or not? If it is an expansion of Rule 1, then we learn something about the nature of guild laws back to the nature of city laws and vice versa. But if they're distinct, So then they might have certain similarities, but in the end they're going to be different. So those are the first two major questions that I'm gonna that I want to deal with as we learn through this sugya. And we'll see that it's not so obvious. Let's for a moment, since both Rami and Yonatan seem to be very into Adam Chashuv. Okay, so now for a moment, let's learn to turn to the question of Adam Chashuv. So the Gemara says, at least in the case of the Tabachim, that if they didn't make the condition with the sanction of the Adam Chashuv, of the important member of society, so then their condition is not effective. So what does having an Adam Chashuv present, what does that tell us? What is the nature of his authority? And what does that tell us about the scope of, or the source of, the power of the community to make rules for themselves? I'm going to let someone else weigh in before Yonatan. I see what Yonatan said both in his first and last comment, and I think Yonatan is on to something, but I want to clarify it first. Rami, you, okay. Yes.
Andrew and I were sort of like going over this, and I would say the entire idea of like the Adam Chashuv seems weird.
Because
because of the presence of a superhuman, therefore the agreements made between individuals is no longer considered to be binding.
Okay, good. So you have a problem. Now give me an explanation. Yes, the Adam Chashuv case is weird. So now tell me why it's weird. You told me why it's weird. So now try to give me an explanation. Right? Why should the existence of a superhuman undermine the ability of people to make rules for them, to make agreements among themselves? Okay. Fair question. So you tell me.
I guess the... Okay, so what I think we have to more strictly clarify, specify like different types of agreements. Because I think the only way to reasonably get it here is by saying that there's different specify that there's different types of obligations. If someone made a neder, for example. I don't think the presence of a Adam Chashuv would automatically negate that neder. And so, likewise, I think if someone made a contract with witnesses, I don't think that can Adam Chashuv can just
okay, good. Do that. So, Rami, you're thinking along the right lines here. So, Rami takes as a given that an Adam Chashuv is not relevant in every type of agreement or every type of commitment, for that matter, right? If we want to rephrase what you said, right? A neder is a commitment, and a contract is an agreement. And Rami correctly notes that an Adam Chashuv is irrelevant to what you commit to what neder you make, and to what you agree to. You're allowed to make any contract you want. Good. So now Rami has a question. If that's the case, then why suddenly, magically, in whatever's going on in our Gemara, is an Adam Chashuv relevant? Good. So now answer your question. Let's try to answer it.
So... now we're dealing with a soft, unspoken agreement.
It's not unspoken. It's what do you mean? They made an explicit agreement that you get Sunday, Tuesday, Thursday. I get Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And if you don't keep the rules, then you're going to be punished. That's explicit.
Okay, fine.
Right? Anyone who doesn't, right, who works b'yom d'chavrei will be punished. Right? Good, so let's push it. Come on.
Now we're entering into really problematic territory, because that seems like explicit contract territory, which I don't see how you could possibly retroactively just deny.
Okay. So Rami here. Wait. One second, Rami. Let me spell it. Let me tease out from what you said something, okay? So Yehonatan had said that the basis of our sugya are the existence of communal obligations, which we already talked about, is a sort of unique type of agreement. It's not an explicit, right? It's not a contract. It's just the presumed agreements that exist in a community. And our entire sukkah is an expansion of that notion that there are explicit communal obligations and there are implicit communal obligations. There are ones that we need to delineate and ones that are assumed. But fundamentally, they come, you know, the way Rav Schechter said it, it's not because of contract law, it's super contract. It's we are in it together, right? We live in a community, and therefore there must be rules, but we don't per se have to, it's not a contract, right? It's not an explicit shutafut, it's an implicit shutafut. But Rami says, but wait a second, maybe I don't believe that. Maybe, essentially, what's going on here is that this is just a contract, it's just an agreement. And if it's just an agreement, so then an Adam Chashuv makes no sense, right? We're allowed to agree to whatever we want. Okay, so Rami, then let's push it. Well, Rami, you're on mute. Rami, you're on mute. I can't hear you.
Sorry. I think then the explanation would possibly be that there is a... I guess that you do have courts for a reason, because not all contracts can be so you can uphold the validity of a contract. And so perhaps you want to say that the court is going to say that unless you follow following procedures, and you listen to the court, then your contract is not going to be valid. And when you do something in accordance with the court, I don't know, perhaps in this circumstance, it would invalidate whatever clause of the contract that stated that, like, that the butcher wouldn't get paid.
Okay, so let's take up two options here, two variations here. So we have Rami's variation and we have Yehonatan's variation. So Rami says, maybe this really is contract, but even in a contract, there might be some particularly egregious violation of legal norms or something like that, and the Adam Chashuv is just there to weigh in to say, that's too much, right? That goes beyond. You basically have free will and free reign in terms of what agreements you make, but there are certain limitations, right? It's like, in Canada, you can't sign binding arbitration when it comes to settling marriage disputes. You're not allowed to, right? In America, you can choose to say that in a case that, Jack and Jill get divorced, that instead of going to court, they'll go to Beit Din or they'll go to mediation. And in order to make that enforceable, what you do is you sign a binding arbitration agreement that says we must not go to court, we must go to an arbiter. But in Canada, they said it's not the case. You don't even have the right to sign a binding arbitration agreement because we just think that, marriage disputes have to be judged by the courts, and therefore, this is a contract. We can override the contract in certain cases. That's essentially Rami's formulation. Now, Yehonatan's formulation, and this derives from Yehonatan's conviction that what we're talking about here is not regular contract law, but is the unique world of communal obligations, is that no, the role of the Adam Chashuv here is not simply You know, it's not a contract. It's more fundamental, which is that we see the role of leaders, invoking Plato here, as the philosopher king. That the leaders are supposed to be the people who understand the truth. And therefore, they have to make sure that society doesn't do anything stupid. However, I want to point out, Yehonatan, and now I'm going to turn it to you, that you are so convinced that the power here is bottom up, right, is from the community, that you have completely and totally distorted everything that Plato and Socrates believed. By invoking philosopher king in terms of what you just said, you have, right, you've presented a very interesting model, but I want you for a moment to think what Plato or Socrates would actually tell you and give me a different model, because I want you to understand the different possibilities here. So, Yonatan, you can answer either in chat or whatever. I'm watching it. Right, you said that the Adam Chashuv is something like a philosopher king, and that he has to make sure that the people don't establish something detrimental. In your model, conceptually, and Rami's models also, both of you assumed that whatever the power is that we're talking about here, whether in the case of the city or in the case of the guild, is fundamentally a bottom-up power. It comes from the people. And the role of the Adam Chashuv, in different ways, both you and Rami said, is just to make sure that nothing gets out of hand. Right? To make sure that nothing gets out of hand. To make sure that they don't do something which is detrimental. They don't do something that we have to override. But both of you were totally convinced that the power is bottom up. Right? It comes from the people in some way. And therefore, you're convinced that the role of Adam Chashuv, at most, can be to weigh in and say, look, yes, the power comes from the people, but there are limits to the power of the people. But you could look at Adam Chashuv and learn something very different from that. And that is?
Your motivated reason and otherwise.
What?
We have motivated reasoning otherwise.
Meaning what?
What?
Meaning what?
I don't like the idea of a tyrant that can randomly completely destroy agreements between people.
Okay, good. So Rami goes to the other extreme here. Right? Rami goes to the other extreme here. But fine. But Rami says he made a choice to say what he said, because apparently both Rami and Yonatan are convinced that the power must fundamentally be bottom up, right, from the people, and the role in these cases of this Adam Chashuv is at best to act as, to be a check on the authority, you know, make sure they don't do something which is completely out of bounds. However, that's a very weak read. You could have looked at this and said that while the beginning of the Gemara, which says that people can make deals with each other, indicates that communal obligations derive from the people, right? That they come bottom up, they come from the people, and that's what creates the authority, the existence of this power of Adam Chashuv might point in the opposite direction, that maybe power fundamentally is top-down. It comes from leaders. And that's really the given. That really the given is power comes from leaders. The fact that there's some room carved out for rules that emerge from the people, maybe that's not the given, maybe the given is the opposite. Now Rami doesn't like it because he says it sounds like this guy is a tyrant. If you really think that, look, fundamentally power starts at the top and they can override everything. But what I want to point out is that in order to understand our sugya, we need to figure out the negotiation of powers here that is being implied by the Gemara. Because on the one hand, yes, the beginning of the Maariv says nothing about Adam Chashuv and makes it sound like this is very much community-oriented, is contract-oriented, as Rami would have it. Adam Chashuv forces us to imagine a different model of power. Not one which comes from the people, but one that comes from authority, qua authority. One way of doing that is to say that really most power is top-down. But neither Rami nor Yonatan wanted to say that. And therefore, you both push to say that that the Adam Chashuv here is just a check to make sure that what's mostly a bottom-up authority doesn't get out of whack, right? Doesn't get out of control and doesn't do something detrimental to society. But I will note that the case, the model that Yonatan borrowed from Plato of the philosopher king would indicate the possibility that that may not be what's going on, right? Plato's philosopher king simply believes that the people who should be running society are the smartest people, not the hamonam, right? Not the people, but the smart people by virtue of their intelligence, judiciousness, prudence, insight. They get authority because of their expertise. And power for Aristotle, for Plato and Socrates is fundamentally top-down rather than bottom-up. And you could look at Adam Chashuv and believe that that's what it teaches us. Now, I will note that in addition to figuring out what exactly we're supposed to understand from this negotiation of powers between what the people agree to and what the Adam Chashuv says, right, and this override that he seems to have over the people, we also got to figure out a few other things, which is, well, who is this Adam Chashuv, right? What type of Adam Chashuv are we talking about, and why does he have power? So Rami already took the position that an Adam Chashuv is an expert in the field, right? Is an expert in the field, the master butcher. So Rami already takes the claim that an Adam Chashuv is an expert in the field. He's the master butcher. That's all he is. However, you have to wonder, right? There are other possibilities. What else, when you see the words Adam Chashuv, what else might it be besides for an expert in the field? Right, so Gavi, it could be a communal leader, and what else, right? So it could be that it's not about an expert in the field, it could be it could be a statement about politics, it's a political leader, and what else might it be? What does it mean, right? Yonatan also agrees that just some sort of leader, right, some sort of political leader. What else does it sometimes mean, though?
It'd be a Rav.
Thank you, right? It might be a Torah leader, right? It might be a Torah leader. So in addition to figuring out the balance of powers between the bottom-up authority of the people who are agreeing and this Adam Chashuv, which is the first, right, which is one major question we need to address, we need to qualify that question by figuring out who is this Adam Chashuv? Is it, as Rami would have it, simply an expert in the field? And what gives him authority is that he's just, you know, the most senior in the field. So we trust his opinion. Or is it, as Yehonatan or Gavi would have it, is this a political thing? Meaning, there's the power of the people, and then there's the power of the politicians or the leaders. Now that gets interesting, because then not only do you have to balance, you figure out what the balance of authority is in halacha between the people and the leaders, you've got to figure out where the leaders got their authority to begin with. Because the more you believe that in, let's say, a democratic system, the more the leaders to begin with get their power from the agreement of the people, and therefore it could be that the Adam Chashuv is a control on the people's power, but not because he has intrinsic power, but because he represents a certain prior agreement of the people. However, as Adam and Gavi point out, there's another possibility. And this was also implicit in Yehonatan's invocation of Plato and Socrates, which is maybe what we're talking about is a Talmud Chacham, or somebody with good lineage, good yichos, meaning a tzaddik, whatever you want to say. Maybe this isn't the balance simply of the people and the politicians, but it's in the balance of community leadership, right? Lay leadership with rabbinic leadership, or, you know, however you want to define rabbinic leadership, right? Both Gavi and Adam provided some sort of rabbinic leadership model, right? Meaning the rabbinic families, right? The good things like that, or just, you know, the Talmidei Chachamim. But if that's what this is, and this sugya is no longer just about balancing bottom-up power with top-down power, it's about balancing lay leadership with rabbinic leadership, and then you really got to ask the question that bothered Romney before, which is, what role does a rabbi have in weighing in on communal agreements or guild agreements as to when and how you should, shecht an animal? Another question that we have to ask is, the Gemara doesn't actually bring up Adam Chashuv in the first half of the sugya, right? So if you remember, the first half of the sugya deals with communal obligations. The second half of the sugya deals with the obligations of guilds, of people within a certain profession. The Gemara only explicitly invokes this condition of Adam Chashuv, whatever it is, in the context of the guild. So you got to ask, does whatever we learn about the limitations of bottom-up power from this rule called Adam Chashuv, what does it teach us about Adam Chashuv in the context of the city? So remember, this goes back to what we opened with, is if you think that basically they're the same thing, one is just a microcosm of the other, so then Adam Chashuv may have a role in the city as well. But if you think that the guild powers are distinct from the city powers, so maybe Adam Chashuv only has power in the context of the guild, but not in the context of the city. Adam suggested something similar to Rami, that maybe what we're talking about is the person who started the guild, right? Maybe the authority here really is emergent from the guild. It's just someone, right? It's someone who, you know, has a certain seniority. I was going to use the Hebrew word vetek, but a certain seniority. But really, his power emerges from the guild as well. Yes. Another question that we have to deal with that touches on all these issues is, when we say that the community or the guild made an agreement, what does it mean they made an agreement? So this could mean many things, and I'll throw out the possibilities and I want you to think about them. Possibility one is, it could mean they made an explicit agreement about every single thing that they are currently enforcing. That's possibility one. Possibility two is, they made a deal to enter into a community or enter into a guild, but once they've made the deal to enter into the guild, they don't necessarily have to accept each rule in the same way, right? It could be that once you're in the guild, you agree that everything will be arbitrated and all rules will be made by an individual within the guild. So therefore, the process of entering into the community or the guild is not identical to the process of accepting the specific laws. Another question, which is, let's assume that that's not the case. Let's assume that all the rules that we're talking about in the city or in the guild are in fact voted on by the people. Well, there's different types of votes. There's votes that require a simple majority. There are votes that require a supermajority. And there are votes that require the entire community, 100%. So which is it here? And this question may hang on Yehonatan's formulation versus Rami. Right? Rami likes to think about this sugya as contracts. Well, in contracts, anybody who's making a deal probably has to know what they're making a deal about. But if this isn't quite contracts, but it's a more broad institution of communal agreements, so you may not have to agree al pi rov, right? You may not have to agree to every little thing. So once you enter the society, you may be bound by a simple majority, even if it goes against your needs. So we have to ask that question as well, which is even within the context of these rules, how do we adjudicate the rules? How do we make the rules? How many people need to be involved? Okay, so like I said, today I really wanted just to sketch out the problems here. So let me review what they are. One is, where does the authority come from for people in the city to make rules? Where's the authority for the people in the guilds to make rules? Where does that come from? And are they the same or are they distinct? Three, what is the role of the Adam Chashuv here? Is he a qualifier? He's just making sure that things don't get out of whack, but fundamentally the power comes from the people? Or does his existence show that power in halacha can't just be bottom-up, it has to be top-down? Whatever it is, who is the Adam Chashuv and what does it teach us? Is it someone who's important in the guild? Is it a political leader? Is it a rabbinic leader? What does this tell us about the interaction between authority and the populace in general, or secular authority, the lay authority, and rabbinic authority? The next question is, to what extent is whatever limitation exists on Adam Chashuv, is that true both for the cases of the city and for the case of the guild, and to what extent is it limited to the case of the guild? And maybe the city rules are different. Maybe they don't need Adam Chashuv. And how, even when the decisions are made by the people, how are they made? Are they made by simple majority? Are they made by rules, set out principles of how to make decisions? Do they require unanimity? Do they require everyone to vote? And depending on what you think, what would that tell you about the authority in question? Okay. That was hard enough on Zoom because I can't see your faces and I can't hear you without also hearing Rabbi Ginsburg here in the background. So tomorrow I will be in yeshiva and we'll continue the analysis, and hopefully when we're all in person we can flesh this out in a more productive way, but I hope it wasn't terrible, and at least the basic questions that you have to ask become clear, and then I'll give you makoros to start fleshing them out tomorrow. The ones I started giving you are the Mordechai and the back. Those are pretty long to begin with, but that's what we'll do tomorrow. And then once we've done that, which will take a day or two, we can spend a day talking about how this became the basis for the modern discussion of labor unions in the 1950s, when the Yishailas started to become really front and center. Labor unions, the propriety of using strikes and things like that, those really emerged from these sugya. Okay.